this discussion. However, based on what I know for the workload for the monkfish agenda item, and depending upon how comments go today, I'm inclined to let the discussion for Habitat and the two comment letters that we'll be discussing run over a little bit. I don't think that the monkfish agenda item is going to take a full hour, unless there's objection from the council. That's how I'm going to proceed. Okay, Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning we have two items to consider. Both of them are letters to be sent out. One is a review and approval of the draft council comments on the Minerals Management Services Cape Wind Energy Project, DEIS. And the other one is the draft council comments on the revised framework. They're both action items, and I'll be presenting at some point this morning motions relating to them. The first one is the Cape Wind Energy Project, and I'd like to make a couple of general comments on it, having looked at all this, the relevant information on it, and then go over the letter in detail. Because there is an awful lot in it, and some of it's been extremely contentious. First of all, as general comments, the Cape Wind Energy Project is a very large, very complex, and for all the reasons we all know, something like it is necessary. We've talked continuously here about fuel costs and all of the other overhead issues that relate to energy, and we know that something of this type is going to be beneficial. As we do the cost-benefit on it, though, we have to bear in mind that the cost-benefit is personal, it's also community and societal, as well as economic. And all of these issues have come into play. I've gotten an enormous amount of email on just this issue, particularly in the last week. The complexity of it involves any inputs that that require different types of expertise. So we're going to have input from a lot of different types of expertise that range everywhere from engineering to fisheries. And I think that what we have to bear in mind here is that each person that's involved, an entity that's involved with this project, has to stay pretty much with what he or she knows or will become less effective. In the case of the New England Council, we need to stay focused in our comments on fisheries issues. And I point that out because the emails that I've received on this cover a very broad range of topics that relate to the Cape Wind Energy Project. And we have to be careful because if we get too broad in our comments, we will become less effective. And we each have personal beliefs where this issue is concerned, but we also have personal areas of expertise. And I think we need to bear that in mind. The other thing is that as far as habitat issues are concerned, the greatest direct role that our omnibus habitat amendment has had so far in fisheries management has been our consultative role. We really haven't done much in the way of direct fisheries management. But under Magnuson-Stevens Act, we are called upon in a consultative role, and I would like to protect that. And the way to protect that is to stay with the issues that we are familiar with and the ones that relate directly to habitat. And in line with that, the Cape Wind Energy Project has the potential not only to be an enormous asset to the area, but it also has the potential to be a rather large threat to habitat. We have, within the area of just the Horseshoe Shoal alone, we have, and not including Lewis Bay, that's a different issue, we have 12 species or life stages that are designated as EFH, essential fish habitat. They cover five species that are managed by the New England Fishery Management Council, one of which is an HAPC. And those are, just to give you an idea of what it is that we're covering here, in Atlantic cod, we have EFH for eggs, larvae, juveniles and adult, and in fact, the juveniles cod is also, it's, the area is also designated in HAPC, Habitat Area of Particular Concern. With Little Skate, we have both juveniles and adult, EFH. Windowpane flounder, juveniles and adult, EFH. Winter flounder, juveniles and adult, EFH. And in Winter Skate, it's designated as EFH for both juveniles and adults. It's a total of 12 essential fish habitats that are encompassed within the Horseshoe Shoal region. And with that, that doesn't count species that are managed by the Mid-Atlantic Council. That's just the ones that are managed by the New England Council. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to go over the draft letter that has been put together for this council to consider, and which will go out to the Minerals Management Service. The letter is divided into three general areas, three topic areas. One is general comments on the draft environmental impact statement. One is comments that are specific to each section. And the third section is recommendations, and I'd like to go over those. Looking at the bullets on general comments on the DEIS, the first bullet relates to report references, and it's basically a mechanics of how the DEIS is done. After throughout the DEIS, you need a comma in there. It relates to the guidelines of the Council on Environmental Quality, and basically that the reports that are used by the preparer of the DEIS has to be capable of being understood by the reader without the need for undue cross-reference. That's from the guidelines of the CEQ. And the references in the EIS, DEIS, do not fulfill that requirement, and they need to be redone. They need to have a brief description of the contents of the report, and also the contents need to be briefly summarized wherever they're referenced in the EIS. The next bullet relates to the classification of fishing within biological or within the EIS under biological resources. That's incorrect, and the fishing should be classified under socioeconomic resources and land use under its own subheading. Okay, moving over to the next page, page 2, comments specific to the DEIS sections. The first bullet refers to the scour protection, which is going to emerge as a major issue. There's confusion in the EIS on how that's worded, how it's presented. The EIS refers to two types of scour protection, and it's not clear from the document which type the proponent intends to use or what mix of types are intended to be used, which makes it difficult, if not impossible, to get a grip on the effects of these two types of scour protection. The second bullet relates to, again, to scour protection, but also to the specifications for cable inspection. And what it says is that it refers to the anticipated inspection schedule, and it talks about the reference that references the prudence of conducting an inspection after any significant storm activity. But it should be more specific than that. It should state specifically if that's merely a prudent action or if it's the proponent's intention, and further, if such an inspection is in addition to the schedule proposed or in place of one or more scheduled inspection. And further down, we have more to talk about with the inspections. The next section, affected environment, there's a problem with the first bullet. There's a problem with the statistical area designation. That needs to be clarified. The next bullet and the one, two after it, both refer to the statistics using interviews. And in fisheries, we wouldn't get away with this. It would be called anecdotal, the way they put it in the EIS. They summarize interviews with five shellfish and coastal officers, and that includes a summary reporting commercial and recreational harvesting on the shoal. This is clearly inadequate. And to jump ahead to and then go back, the bottom bullet on that page says, in the survey of commercial and recreational fishing activities, There's reference to a survey of 18 commercial and fish gear fishermen. And that statistic is meaningless without some descriptive statistics that cover both the nature of the sample and the universe of commercial and fixed gear fishermen in question. In other words, by using that, that lacks statistical authority, and you can't really derive any useful information from the way it's done. Moving back now, there's just a clarification, the bullet before that. There's a sentence in section 4.2.7.1 that says in the Northeast region, NOAA Fisheries works with the and also. They did not insert New England Fishery Management Council there. That needs to be done so that we don't get marginalized. Okay, next page, page 3. The environmental and socioeconomic consequences. The first one, Section 5.3.1.1.1, relates to scour control, and again, it should specify which version they prefer or how they are going to evaluate one relative to the other vis-a-vis the effects on the habitat. That is not done. The next bullet is relates to the effect of transmission lines, and their intention is to bury the transmission line 6 feet below the seabed, but we need more discussion in the EIS on the impacts of this kind of line, exposure to this kind of line, on commercial fishing activities. That's not adequate. The next one is relates to the effects of rock armor. The conclusion in the DEIS is that the operation impacts on oceanographic processes would vary from negligible to minor and would result in only temporary and localized effects. Yet they say that they're going to be using a permanent or semi-permanent addition of some 48 acres of rock piles in an area of that's a generally sand or coarse granule dominated bottom, and our contention is that that is neither minor, temporary, nor localized. That has to be more adequately addressed. The next bullet relates to rock armor versus scour mats, and again we've got this this question of which what they are going to do, what the extent of it is, and the costs and benefits associated with those two options. They need to be more clearly delineated. The next section, 5.1.5.11, has some serious problems with it. It has two mutually exclusive sections in it. One is the conclusion that monopiles are unlikely to attract fish, and the other one says that they will act as fish-attracting devices. And it extrapolates that the monopiles will attract particular fish species, Atlantic cod, Cunard, Tautog, sea bass, and scup. That conflict needs to be reconciled because it doesn't work the way it's written. And the last bullet in that section, egg and larvae entrainment, there's a considerable problem here because it states that in 5.3.2.8, it states that the eggs and larvae entrained would likely suffer 100% mortality and that millions of fish eggs and larvae may be present in the withdrawn water. There's no indication in there of the magnitude of water withdrawal or the temporal period over which it will be engaged in, and that makes it impossible to establish from this EIS what the actual magnitude of the egg and larvae entrainment will be, and that's an important issue for us in fisheries, and that needs to be more clearly stated. Under monitoring and mitigation, The first one is difficult to understand. Section 9.2 appears to use lessons learned from energy projects overseas, but makes no reference to the monitoring that's occurred on Horseshoe Shoals, and we need to have that cleared up as well. The next one, I think, is a very serious deficiency in the DEIS, and that's section 9.4.5, which talks about cable inspection plan and communications of cable exposures. We need to have guidance here in this EIS on the inspection procedures and timing. That has to be part of it, as well as a communications plan. If there's a cable exposure, which can be expected, I'm not an engineer, but I'm sure that given the currents there and the nature of the bottom, there's going to be some problems with cable exposure. We need to know what their inspection plan is, and specifically, there has to be some way to identify who is going to be notified in the event of a cable exposure. That's not clear at all. And it particularly has to be clear that commercial fishermen have to be included within the universe of people that are going to be notified in the event of an exposure of electrical cable. Okay, going on into recommendations. There are three basic recommendations. The first is that relates to Lewis Bay, which I haven't spoken of at all. Lewis Bay is an area, an EFH for the winter flounder larvae, and that needs to be during the time when there's a sensitivity to that. The schedule needs to be adapted to that. So the project schedule should be revised to avoid in-water work within Lewis Bay from January 15th to May 31st to protect the sensitive life stages of winter flounder. The second recommendation, once again, gets to the scour control issue that needs to be settled. The first is that the choice of scour control is of critical concern due to the variance of potential impacts to EFH and benthic communities. And the conclusion is that the choice of scour control methods and the rationales for that choice must be made clear prior to project approval. And the last one is relates to monitoring. There has to be a monitoring program, a published monitoring program, and the plan for monitoring needs to be reviewed and approved by federal and state resource agencies prior to project approval. And briefly, that's the contents of the letter. I would like to get any feedback from people, and then I'm going to propose a motion to accept this letter as written.
Thanks, Dave. Any questions or comments from the council? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, David, it's a good letter. However, I'm reminded that the council has already commented on the Cape Wind Energy project. I can't recall the exact date when we did so, but we already have comments on record regarding our concerns, questions about this particular project. And I wonder if the letter as now written, the letter before us, repeats those comments, highlights those comments. I ask the question because I note in a letter that was given to us this morning by the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound that they've highlighted in their second paragraph that the current draft of the DEIS, they say, does not address some of the significant issues that have been previously raised by the council. And these are significant issues, they remind us, that relate to fishermen's use of the area and, in particular, fishermen's safety. So my question is that true? If it is true, then I would suggest we take a look at that letter and repeat those concerns, ask those same questions, since we've asked them before, and we need to ask them again if they have not already been addressed. And again, the Alliance is indicating that they have not been raised by us in this letter again. So perhaps, Mr. Chairman, we could ask those representing the Alliance to give us a summary of the comments that they have given us this morning, and we could also ask them to indicate, why they think that this particular draft letter we're considering now is missing important information that we've highlighted before.
Yeah, I do plan to go to the audience, Dave. I want to make the rounds here at the council table before I do that. Anyone else on the council? Dave Simpson.
Yeah, I just had a question on page 4, the recommendation for the project schedule to avoid in-water work in Lewis Bay from January 15 to May 31. It sounds, you know, for winter flounder, the time frame sounds a little bit long, although I understand it. And then what type of in-water activity is of concern? Typically, it's the concern would be dredging, you know, physical removal of the eggs or high turbidity in a muddy, you know, river-type situation where turbidity could cause some additional mortality of larvae. So could you explain a little bit about what the thought was behind those time frames?
Yes, Chad. Where's Chad? I'd like to turn that one over to Chad. We can expand on that. The in-water work that I had in mind here is just exactly what you were saying, the stuff that increases turbidity. But I'd like to have Chad address that.
The issue is basically laying the electrical transmission line through Lewis Bay from the project site up into Hyannis. To do that, they're not dredging out the area. They're using, and I'm drawing a blank on the word right now, but they're using a process that essentially liquefies the substrate, and then they lay the cable on top of that, and then the cable sinks down into the liquefied substrate. So what we're trying to do, and this echoes comments that are made by a lot of other agencies, MassDMF and NOAA in particular, that these are the times where juvenile and larvae and egg, winter flounder, EFH, are at their most susceptible. And the project right now, I think, calls for, I think the EIS says that they won't be doing any work between January 1 and May 15. So we're just asking for them to shift that back 2 weeks on either side. I might be wrong on that, but I'm close in any case. But again, the major work in Lewis Bay that's of issue is the laying of the electrical transmission line.
Okay, thanks. That helps. Typically that type of work doesn't produce a whole lot of turbidity. It's not like dredging, you know, 500,000 yards out of a harbor or something like that. So I wouldn't view it as a very large concern. The couple of weeks shift. Again, usually you're trying to protect the eggs and early larval stages. The juveniles are much better off, you know, able to fend for themselves. So just something to think about.
Anyone else on the council? Sally McGee.
Yeah, I had a few things. The original letter that the council submitted was actually 3 years ago, and it went to the Army Corps of Engineers, and then the jurisdiction switched for this project over to the Minerals Management Service. And I was just taking a look at that letter, and one of the things I think that was helpful in the council exerting its authority as far as that goes is for consulting on projects like this is that it included charts and a table explaining the essential fish habitat by species and life stage. So it's clear to Minerals Management Service what the jurisdiction is of the council and what the impact is. So I think that would be helpful to add a table describing the specific species and life stages that are affected by this project. That's changed, obviously, in the last 3 years, and it would probably be useful to look at the new EFH designations, even though they haven't yet been submitted to NMFS and aren't quite official yet, but through the omnibus amendment, presumably those were the species and life stages that Dave was referring to, because it's a smaller number than were originally submitted in the letter back in 2005 to the Army Corps of Engineers. The other thing is, in that comment letter, there were several comments on impacts on the intertidal zone, and I think that is something that the council, while obviously we don't have jurisdiction over, the intertidal zone. The EFH designations, as everybody knows, extend well into and above the intertidal zone. So the potential impacts of this project were described in this letter, and I just ask if perhaps staff could go back and take a look at a number of those comments specific to that area and be highlighted in our letter. And then the last thing, and I'm sure that we'll get further comments on this, with respect to the safety issue that was raised, my recollection of that discussion was that there was concern expressed by Coast Guard as far as the ability for air rescue to deploy in the area that would be affected. Thank you.
Thank you, Sally. I think your two comments are excellent. If there's not an objection from the council, I'll ask that staff go back and try to insert some tables and charts. Chad?
Just point out that the Mineral Management Services EIS on this is a much different beast than the Army Corps of Engineers. They actually incorporated the EFH tables that were in our letter into the DEIS now, so I'm not sure if that's really, and it might be redundant in any case. Happy to do it if that's what we need, but those are in the document.
Well, sometimes you need to say something more than once.
It'll be updated.
And the intertidal zone comments, are you familiar with what Sally's referring to there?
Honestly, no, but I'll figure it out.
Okay, is there any objection from the council to enhancing the letter that we have in front of us with those two items? Okay, anyone else on the council? Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. Can anybody tell me how deep and how wide that trench they're going to liquefy is going through Lewis Bay?
Chad, do you recall the depth and width of the liquefied trench?
No, I could make up some numbers. It's kind of in the ballpark of 60 feet wide, but no, I'm not really sure specifically.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gatel.
Yeah, I have a couple questions, but also kind of a statement that, in a sense, a letter we're sending is like we're conducting a negotiation here. The letter is a form of negotiation, and we don't have a particularly strong hand in this negotiation. Our hand is pretty much EFH, and therefore most of the comments we have are related. They're EFH-related comments. But I do have a question about whether or not the council should comment on things that are outside of EFH, specifically the social and economic concerns for fisheries in this area, which are definitely going to be impacted. I can't say which way. I doubt it's going to be positive, but it might be positive for a few where people can fish around those rock piles or something with some new complex bottom if you're a hook and line fisherman, but definitely negative for people that tow mobile gear in the area because they're not going to be able to fish there. And I think we should comment on that, that they should at least provide some kind of an analysis of the social and economic effects of taking a pretty, well, it was a 24-square-mile area or something, and basically altering the fishing capabilities in that area. And the second one is safety, which I know the Coast Guard will comment on, but, you know, we have a concern with safety, too. And I think we should comment on it, that we remain concerned of the safety aspects of this project, not only from search and rescue aspects, but also from navigation through the area. This is a heavily traveled area by a number of vessels, not just fishing vessels. And it's a dynamic area. It's not an easy area to navigate, and I think we should comment on that. I agree with Sally's comments, what we've already stated, that we should reiterate our managed species EFH. And lastly, on number two in the last page, I think we need to be a little bit more specific about what our concerns are, or at least list one more concern. I have had a concern for a long time, and I continue to have that concern, that these cables that are buried are going to have an electromagnetic field associated with them. Now, if they stay 6 feet under the surface, that field is probably pretty well negated before it reaches the ocean. But if they become unburied and they're not properly shielded, they're going to give off an electromagnetic field. And I'm not an expert on this, but the best way I can describe it is if you've got a single sideband radio, take your antenna wire, run it within a couple feet of your compass, and hit the transmit button and watch what happens to your compass. You know, it goes... Rrr. And if you're a fish and you're navigating through this area, you're a migratory fish, you're using some kind of cue to navigate that area. And quite frankly, we don't know what those cues are. You know, they probably have some kind of electromagnetic component. That's how birds appear to migrate. And I remain concerned that we have some species that are showing precipitous decline, such as river herring, that definitely migrate through this area. Squid come there to spawn. There's some capacity or capability to get into that area, and if we disturb it, it may have unknown effects that we can't predict, and we should at least have some kind of a monitoring program in place, both before and after these things are built, to say what it was before, and, you know, if things change after, you know, being able to monitor that change. So those are the suggestions I would have that I would like to see the council discuss and possibly add to the letter.
All right, Dave, so I've taken notes there. The issue of safety was one, and the other was enhanced social and economic discussion and points made, and then further development of the electromagnetic disturbance that could be caused by the transmission cable.
Right, if it becomes unburied.
Okay. Dave Preble.
Thank you. That last one I think is particularly good. To be honest with you, I hadn't even thought about that. But river herring do migrate with electromagnetic cues, and you do have a field around a transmission wire. I think that's a good one, and I think we need to explore that more. I think there needs to be some kind of monitoring in place. I think that's a good idea.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you. I could see a huge safety concern for pleasure craft traveling from Vineyard Haven to Hyannis. Going through there, they're going to be shifted right over into the steamer lanes or into the fishing area. Right now, you take a pleasure craft that goes from, say, Edgartown up into Hyannis, they cross Horseshoe Shoal. They go right across it to get there. They're going to have to reroute their way, and they're going to either be impacted by the steamers running from Hyannis to Nantucket or the fishing vessels fishing there. So I could see in the thick fog a huge safety concern. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Okay, we'll go to the audience. Anyone in the audience wish to speak? Audrey?
Thank you. My name is Audra Parker, and I'm with the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to the long-term protection of Nantucket Sound and have some concerns on the impacts on fisheries. I'll focus my comments on the discrepancies between the issues raised in the draft letter currently under consideration and issues that were raised in previous letters that were alluded to. The Council submitted comments on the Cape Wind, DEIS, and DEIR to the Army Corps, the Mass Executive Office of Environmental Affairs, and the Cape Cod Commission in February of 2005, and you submitted a nearly identical letter to MMS on the Notice of Intent to prepare an EIS for Cape Wind on July of 06. The current draft represents a drastic departure from the previous letters. The current letter focuses largely on scour protection issues and omits discussion of many other significant issues that were previously raised by the Council and that would face fishermen if the proposed project is allowed to go forward. The first example concerns impacts to fishing. The previous letter stated that, quote, the Council is concerned that the proposed project has the potential to adversely affect fishing activities within the wind park due to the uncovering of cables. It goes on to say that if the cables become exposed, commercial fishing activities may be excluded from the area due to conflicts with trawling gear. By contrast, the current draft does not express these concerns, but only requests more extensive discussion and better monitoring. Furthermore, the previous letters state that analysis of the impacts of the towers on commercial fishing is needed as they may preempt other bottom uses in this area. The current draft completely omits any mention of the impacts of the towers themselves on fishing and focuses only on the cables. The previous letters criticized the lack of data on recreational fishing activity, stating that the DIS underestimates the amount of effort expended and fails to characterize the financial contribution made to the local economy. Again, the current letter does not make any mention of specific concerns for recreational fishing. On safety and navigation, the previous letters offer significant discussion. The current letter totally drops this topic, as has been mentioned. There's no mention of the Magnuson Act, National Standard 10, which promotes safety of life at sea, or the resulting restrictions on fishing activity that would be required. There's absolutely no mention of concerns previously expressed by the U.S. Coast Guard, and no mention of previous concerns by the counselor made that, quote, the safe and effective use of mobile gear would be very difficult in a field of wind turbine generators because of the maneuverability of the gear and the potential for collision with the structures or other vessels, particularly in foul weather conditions. The previous letters include extensive discussion of essential fish habitat and the council's belief that the project may negatively impact habitat of some or all the species. The letter specifically states, quote, shifting a high-energy, sandy shoal environment to one dominated by rigid vertical structures will impact habitat for many species. While the current draft acknowledges that the council is empowered to consider impacts to essential fish habitat for species under their jurisdiction, there's no discussion of impacts beyond one statement that reads, quote, scour mats appear the least likely to cause an adverse impact to EFH. Finally, while both letters express concern in the recommendation section on the impacts the proposed project would have on the habitat necessary to maintain healthy fish stocks and the impact that the project may have on commercial fisheries, the new letter drops the statement that the project, quote, has a high likelihood of adversely impacting EFH for many federally managed species. Many fishermen from Cape Cod, from the islands of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, and from surrounding areas depend on Horseshoe Shoal for their livelihoods and much of their income. I request that the Council address their concerns about the proposed Cape Wind project, as well as the critical issues that have been raised by you in previous letters in the final letter that you distribute or send in to MMS. Thank you.
Thanks, Audra. Ed Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the council's letter, but frankly, I'm a little disappointed in it. I'm a commercial fisherman that fishes down there, and this project is going to be putting 130 44-story structures in what is essential fish habitat. And not to go back on the habitat discussion that's already happened here, but in the DEIS, they admit that they're going to be blasting, dredging, and jet plowing. And that includes 60 miles of transmission cables. Impacts like that are not minimal. They are major. This is a major squid spawning ground. Probably the major squid spawning ground on the eastern seaboard. Squid being the building block in the food chain for a lot of, for you know, almost every single species in the multi-species stock. This is going to have a major impact on fisheries in New England. Secondly, this is going to be a 24-square-mile closure. We're spacing, they're going to be putting these 44-story structures a third of a mile apart. You will not be able to tow between structures a third of a mile apart in Nantucket Sound where you're constantly dealing with a knot and a half current when you're towing at 2.5 knots. This will be a closure. The socioeconomic impact of this project According to a study that the Mass Fishermen's Partnership will be releasing, based on analysis used in such cases as the Exxon Valdez, will reveal that this is a $5 to $8 million a year impact, with a multiplier using NIMS models of 3 on the rest of the on the rest of the Cape Cod economy. This is going to be a safety problem. If anyone has ever fished down there and knows the thick black fog that exists down there, with the radar interference and the inability to pick small targets out of an area which 100-foot scallopers transit, ferry traffic transits, this is a disaster waiting to happen. The Lady of Grace, which sunk on the southern end of this field, is a prime example of what won't be able to happen if this thing is built. If that vessel had been able to put a distress signal off and the crew had lasted another half hour, they would have well been into that field, and an air search and rescue would not have been able to be conducted under those conditions. The letter being generated, the letter from the council has been generated for the Habitat Committee, but it is from the council, and I think that you have to consider all the impacts from all the national standards, and I think this thing needs to be rewritten, and I really feel that the impacts of all these things are major, and there's nothing in this that's going to be of minor or insignificant impact. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Madam Lemon?
Morning. My name is Jack Lennon. I'm a retired Coast Guard officer, and I worked as a consultant for the Alliance since about January to look at the navigational impacts of this project if it goes forward. I've seen your draft comments. As has been noted, the Alliance provided you with some comment on that on Friday, and there will be copies of that out on the table should anyone care to pick them up. In my look at the project and the way it's laid out, it is clearly going to be, would be too close to both the North Channel and the main channel of Nantucket Sound, 300 yards and one in the former, 400 yards in the latter. And it's also going to be too close to the ferry routes between Hyannis and Nantucket. A 10-knot vessel that loses power in either the north or south channel has about 60 seconds before he can be right in the middle of that and impact one of these towers. The practice in Europe, where there are several of these, is to provide separation from navigation channels of a mile and a half to 2 miles, and this would be much closer to that. As I said, in one case, 300 yards, and another, 400. As Ed pointed out, they're too close together. They're about a 0.4 mile to 0.6 mile apart. And as you pointed out in your earlier letter, I think the 2006 letter, you need a mile to 2 mile circle in order to be able to turn around if you get caught down or if you want to reverse course. So, in effect, nobody's going to be able to operate trawlers in there if this thing is built. A couple of experts, not being paid by anybody, but people who are concerned about it, looked at the effects of this construction on marine radars, and they're significant. There will not only be people masked by being behind one of these structures, but also they see the potential for what they call side lobes, where a target will show up. Not where he is, but where the radar might think he is. And You know, the Coast Guard has, in their terms and conditions, directed that the Alliance do a, quote, research analysis of the effects of this construction on marine radars. One of their consultants, ESS Group, in their navigational assessment said, this is too complicated to figure out until it's constructed. Well, I would submit that it's too late to figure it out at that point in time. The DEIS notes a low incidence of search and rescue activity in the area. As Ed pointed out, Lady of Grace, and there was one other scratcher, I think, have sunk there in the last few years. And I don't know that past search and rescue statistics are necessary or necessarily a good predictor of what's going to happen in the future. I'm not an aviator. I'm a surface sailor. But I doubt that if one gets into trouble in the middle of the night or in foggy conditions in between those towers, that they're not going to see a helicopter lowering them, a swimmer or a pump or whatever, but they're going to have to wait for a boat from Woods Hole or Brant Point or somewhere. So I question whether the search and rescue resources that you need if you're going to be operating in there are going to be available to you if they build this thing. The comment period ends the 21st. I would encourage individuals, first of all, we'd like to see your letter, as has been mentioned, beefed up a bit to talk about the safety issues. But if others care to comment, we're going to leave some forms out on the table in which you can respond directly to MMS. The comment period ends the 21st. Thank you.
Tom Osmers from the great state of Martha's Vineyard.
Thank you, John.
Great nation, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did actually testify two times, once on the vineyard at a Cape Wind Minerals Management Services hearing, and also went to Boston in the company of the chairman of the tribe of the Aquinnah-Wampanoags, as well as the granddaughter of the medicine man of the tribe. Horseshoe Shoal, as you gentlemen know, is a unique marine ecosystem, a settlement area, spawning and juvenile holding and feeding location for the sea bass, the flounder, many of these fishes. Dave did a great job of explaining that, the window pane. It was a codfish grounds, the river herring, the oceanic herring, scup, spawning ground for the squid, as well as a settlement area for the menhaden, because it's mostly a southerly lateral drift that happens from the waters of Buzzards Bay and the Cape, but most of the eggs and the larvae moves to the south. And on top of that, it's the breeding ground and a hibernation area for both the smooth and the knobby whelks, which fishery represents the greatest landings for our island, for the island of Martha's Vineyard. It's the largest fishery on the island. If you look in the literature, the life history of the conch, the knobby and smooth whelk, is not well described. In fact, these creatures hibernate at depths varying from 8 to 12 inches below the surface of the sand. They travel to their traditional grounds where they feed and where they hibernate by following the slime trail of the larger conchs. It's the big fishery for us. Most of the boats on the island fish at least half of their gear on Horseshoe Shoal. We're there constantly. It's mostly the place where the vineyard guys center their activities, begin their operations in the early summer. And as we migrate our gear back towards the island, we all pass through the Horseshoe. I mean, it's a series of guzzles. There's one major guzzle to about two thirds to the south side of the Horseshoe Shoal, which the big boats that go mobile gear fishing travel through that guzzle. I mean, they put windmills right in the middle of the damn thing, as if they had no idea that this is, you know, an area that the boats use to access the Horseshoe Shoal, to avoid going through the North Channel by the Wreck Shoal, or to avoid going around Cross Rip to the southern. The Northwest Quadrant, meanwhile, is very shoal water. There's going to be massive dredging and earth moving, or, you know, moving the sediments on the bottom. It took thousands of years for this place to develop, And, you know, it functions as a food distribution and refuge and settlement area for many of these important fish populations. It took thousands of years to develop this unique ecosystem of microhabitats necessary to the life of many of these fishes managed both by the New England Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council. The bottom profile, meanwhile, of the Horseshoe Shoal, especially in the middle and the southwest quadrant. I fish Horseshoe Shoal. I mean, this is where I spent a lot of time in that, but I never saw Jim Gordon or any of that gang out there poking around. Otherwise, I would have gone up to them and talked to them. The middle and southwest section of the shoal, I bet I could change his mind if I could have a half an hour with Jim Gordon. But the southwest section, constantly changing series of sand lumps, some of it 60 and 70 degree, 15 and 20 feet straight up and down. I have my doubts as to how good of a job they're going to be able to do to lay those cables. I also tried to get some more information of exactly, you know, what kind of lines go to each windmill. And to the best of my knowledge, it's not only an electric transmission cable, which raises some issues that Dave had brought up, but also lubricating oils are going to have to go to each windmill and back from the windmill, like a hydraulic line. So two lines to each one of these 133 towers. We all know about hydraulics and how those things work and how we're constantly carrying the jugs down to the engine room. The bottom does not remain constant. You can take the words of Captain Bob Sampson of the Scratcher, who, when he ran aground with his boat, the Scratcher, there on Horseshoe Shoal and sank the boat, he said, "Things are changing." He says, "It's really changed out there." And it does change constantly. Coming off the shoal to the northern, if you watch your sound machine, it's almost, it's 60 degrees, a drop down. I don't see how the cables are going to stay there. Especially in light of the volumes of water moving over the shoal at velocities which vary with the wind and tide and storm events. There's also a lot of, sea clams, razor clams, quahogs. It's a place that's full of life, essential fish habitat. Sometimes we set a conch trap and we can't haul it. It's full of sand. Other times you pull the conch trap up after a piece of weather, a northeaster or something, it'd be full of sea clams. The bottom is moving constantly. Meanwhile, over 50% of the fishery landings on Martha's Vineyard Island are Horseshoe Shoal related. The vineyard fishermen regard this industrial project as a taking of our fishing ground and as a threat to fish populations and conch well-being, and the effects of which will be felt as far away as North Carolina. Also, as I said, I made inquiries about the hydraulic lines, the lubrication plans. It's not very comforting. We strongly urge the no-action alternative on the siting of the Cape Wind project. We point out that in the original Army Corps of Engineers review of it, as one of the alternatives, they listed that Otis Air Force Base, which has been a site of many environmental negatives for the people. There's cancer clusters around it. There's the paved paws radar. There's the water table pollution. A lot of issues. Now, this could actually turn their karmic profile around if they have something like a wind farm at such a location, especially since they've discontinued the Air Force jets at that location. I don't know whether it's possible to suggest to minerals management people that would be a more appropriate location, or perhaps the median strip on Route 6, which would give the population the benefit of getting to see those windmills at work. Like I said, there's a lot of threats. I doubt that any project, industrial project, I mean, the oil man always says, all the oil derricks out here are going to improve the fishing. That's just a vain conceit. Nothing that we can do, any changes we make to what's there, cannot, in fact, it's well proven, will not be positive. I hope I haven't talked too long, you guys. I appreciate the chance to express our vineyard viewpoint. I know that the word mitigate appears many times in there. I mean, I spoke it mostly as an independent against it, in line with the fishing community on the island. And I just think that there's better locations for it. We urge the no-action alternative, or that they find some better location that less damaging to all of these various fish populations and to our our lives. You know, we got a fishing community that now survives basically by, you know, dint of these the little fish trap fishery that we got for scup and for conch and for sea bass and the squid fishery and the fluke fishery and stuff, and a lot of it's centered around Horseshoe Shoal. Thank you.
Mr. Libby.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Gary Libby, Fort Clyde, Maine. Tom knows more about the area than I do by quite a bit. But my concerns were some comments you guys made, and I do think you're on the right track. It was about the substrate and the egg distribution, because I am a fisherman. I'm always concerned about that, and I'm concerned about essential fish habitat and impacts on that, because if it does impact river herring, you're digging a big hole. That's a large concern. In the comments that the Coast Guard fellow said about the safety, I think that's another large concern. And Dave's comments about the electromagnetic fields that can be caused by cables being uncovered. And after listening to Tom talk, I think there's a very good possibility this type scenario may occur. And to rework this document to add economic impact in with it, I think would be very helpful in making the right decisions on this project. And I thank you for the time to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Living. Anyone else? Okay, back to the council. Yes, ma'am. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Rachel Packner. I'm the assistant project manager for Cape Wind, and I apologize. I did not come prepared to speak today, but I just wanted to clarify just a couple of quick comments made, one by Mr. Barrett, that there would be blasting and dredging. Neither of those are true. There will be no dredging on Horseshoe Shoal. There's a small area in Lewis Bay, I think it's about 60 feet by 40 feet, for a cofferdam when we bring the cables on shore. But we will not be dredging on Horseshoe Shoal, and there will be no blasting. And also, to clarify Mr. Osmer's point, there will be no hydraulic lines running from turbine to turbine. So I just wanted to clarify those points. Thank you.
Anyone else? Anyone else? Eddie.
To the previous speaker's point, the DEIS does mention dredging, and it does mention blasting, because part of Horseshoe Shoal is ledge, and they don't know what they're going to hit. So the possibility does exist that both of those things are going to happen. Jet plowing, burying cables to 6 to 8 feet over up to 60 miles is dredging. And those are impacts that are going to happen on Horseshoe Shoal. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. We've gotten a lot of comments. I think we'll take all those under advisement. I had a question for Jim Rule. Do you know if your council has commented as to the impacts of this project on a species that the Mid-Atlantic manages, the squid?
At this point, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if they have or not, but you can count on one coming in the near future. And the only thing that we've had presentations on the wind farm that was proposed for south of Long Island, and during them presentations, I'm sure we commented on those. And I think we had actually asked you to submit your comments, because that area affected species that you're managing. So I'll be sure to get that letter generated. One thing that did come up in a proposal that's really kind of bothersome is the way they present the size of these structures. And I'm not sure if it was – I can't recall sitting through the presentation of your council. But when they talk about the size of the structure, they'll refer to the diameter, the base, the height. But they always talk about the radius of the actual blades. And it's a diameter that you got to worry about. If you're talking about something that's 60 or 70 foot radius, That's very big difference in what the allowable distance that you or safe distance you can get from it. So I'd make people aware that that may be something they want to look into. And I'll get a report back and get that letter generated as soon as possible, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thanks, Jim. I'll be sure to give Pete a call as well just to follow up. Chad, is that April 21st or May 21st?
April.
April. Okay, we've got some work to do. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This council has to make a couple of decisions here. The question here, there's nothing that's been said that I am in any kind of disagreement with. But the question that we have to decide is, on the letter we send in, how much do we want to delve into state waters issues to begin with? And Mid-Atlantic Council fisheries, we need to decide that. And the other thing is Coast Guard issues. Mention is made in one of the letters, I think it came from the Nantucket people, about the problems of bringing helicopters in between the towers. I have no idea. I'm very cognizant of that argument, but I have no idea where the Coast Guard is able to bring their helicopters in. So I don't think that that's something that, you know, I think it's a very valid point, but I don't think that it's something that we can address, because I don't think we have the knowledge to do it. And the other thing is engineering issues, things like the hydraulic lines. I'm very sympathetic to those points of view, but I don't think that we can deal with that. And Dave Gaethel said it very well. He said we are approaching this with what is essentially a reasonably weak hand. And I'd like to concentrate our effort on the things that we do. And that's without, I'm not making any comments against what has been said today. That all of it I agree with, by the way. But I'm not sure how far we want to go. And I think that's the first thing we have to decide. Do we want to get into the state waters issues? Do we want to get into the Mid-Atlantic fisheries issues? And we have to make that decision. And whatever that decision is, then we have to move on it. But that decision has to be made by this council.
That's to your 2 points, Dave. That's why I asked Jim Rule the question I asked him, and I think it would be appropriate for the Mid-Atlantic to weigh in if there are impacts on species they manage, so we're going to follow that up. To the general comment on what should or shouldn't the council comment on, I think we should use as a guideline the national standards and measure this project and the DEIS against the national standards, which are is the guidance this council makes its decisions and writes its plans on. I had Rodney, then Dr. Pierce.
You got to my point. There's more than one species that the Mid-Atlantic Council manages that are up there. Squid, mackerel, butterfish, scup, sea bass, fluke. They're all on Horseshoe Shoal.
Dr. Pierce.
Once again, the last time we commented on this project was July 28, 2006, and the letter went to Dr. Rodney Cluck, the Minerals Management Service individual, the representative, who requested comments on the proposal. Now, those comments that we submitted back then were on a notice of intent to prepare an environmental impact statement. All right. It was a very comprehensive letter, very well done, a lot of input, excellent staff work, and it covers commercial and recreational fisheries issues, safety and navigation, essential fish habitat, and conservation recommendations are provided, all broken down by category within that letter that's about twice as long as the one that we're reviewing right now. So it seems to me that the simplistic approach, one that actually is all-encompassing and actually does embrace comments made by council members around the table and by many individuals in the audience, is to just take a look at that previous letter and see the extent to which the Minerals Management Service has reacted to our comments and our recommendations. If they have, fine. If they haven't, then we need to repeat those comments, emphasize them, and provide those recommendations again. I think it's as simple as that. We need not delve into any other issues or complicate matters by bringing up other issues, because frankly, I don't think there are any other issues to bring up. They have already been adequately dealt with. So that's my suggestion, Mr. Chairman. that I know we don't have much time, but I don't think it will require much time. I think staff review of that particular letter, comparing the letter that we submitted back in 2006 with what we have before us now, would make for a far better 2008 letter that would remind Dr. Kluck that we have already commented on this very significant project, and we care to do so again.
Anyone else on the council? Dana Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, I know it's difficult, and this is a project that the council and the various committees have been watching, but I don't know how we do it, but I think if there is any way possible this council can weigh in on the socioeconomic impact of these things to the fisheries, I think some of us need to be scratching our heads and think how we can do that, because the environmental impacts and is one thing, but obviously if this happens, it potentially could have huge negative impacts. And is there a mechanism, let everybody think about, is there a mechanism that we can comment on that? I think we need to do that. But if it turns out to be a oops, I think we need to have made a weighed in on that up front. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sally McGee.
Yeah, I agree with Dave Preble's comments that we should really be focusing in this letter on what the authority is for the council to comment on. And the Magnuson Act says that we can comment on and consult on projects that impact essential fish habitat. So I think that the letter should be focused fairly narrowly in that regard. But with respect to state waters, EFH can be designated in state waters. Obviously, we don't have any authority to say what happens in that area, but the designation comes from the council. Therefore, I think we need to include some of the comments that I referenced earlier that were in letters that had gone to the Army Corps of Engineers and subsequently to Minerals Management Service when the jurisdiction changed over regarding the intertidal zone. So I don't think that's going beyond what the authority is of the council to comment, and in fact is very specifically focused on what the Magnuson Act says the council should be commenting on, and that is EFH, whether it's in federal or state waters.
Anyone else on the council? Okay. Dave?
Well, I was going to make a motion to accept the letter as written. I'm not sure that that's appropriate at this point. I think we need to include more than is in there.
Yeah, I suggest, Dave, if there's no objection from the council, there's been some suggestions to bolster or beef up the letter and include some information from previous letters or reference previous letters written by this council, and also to add some charts and tables and such. So if there is an objection, you can work with staff to perform those tasks. And
the only thing I want to make plain is so that it needs to be focused on what's in the DEIS. The previous letter had a different focus, and we need to just zero right in on the EIS, the DEIS, and address issues that are in that. I don't want to see us spin our wheels by trying to take on more than is appropriate. That's the thing that concerns me here, because I don't want us to be marginalized by spreading too wide a net, I guess is the way to put it.
I think that's a good starting point. However, if there are omissions that or issues not in the DEIS, I think it's within the bounds of this council to comment on those omissions. So if there's no objection, we'll work to enhance the letter with staff. We have a tight turnaround on this letter. Okay. Thank you. The next issue, Dave, is the MPA comment letter.
Mr. Chairman, Chad just indicated that he thinks that he can piece together some revisions to the letter by tomorrow for council approval, if that's acceptable.
Sure.
Okay. And we'll take care of that first thing in the morning.
Well, we'll put it in the we'll slide it in the agenda
slide
wherever
it, okay.
We can.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Okay. The okay, the next letter is relating to the environmental assessment for the National System of Marine Protected Areas. And here we go. Okay. Okay, this one I think is a little more straightforward. The comments on the environmental assessment, basically our comments are is that the EA is insufficient as it is presented. There are a number of issues that need to be cleaned up. First of all, the council continues to disagree with the finding of no significant impact, the FONSI finding that's in the EA, and that is inadequate and incomplete evaluation of the impacts of the framework. And there's only two alternatives given here. And the no action alternative, the first one, is not clear. It's misspecified. The executive order says that wait a minute. I got to get the executive order out. I got it right here. Okay. The executive order states that to the extent permitted by law and subject to the availability of appropriations. And the argument that we have here, the question that we have, is you could make an argument based on this that the failure to develop such a system is a viable component if appropriations are lacking. So there seems to be a problem with this appropriations clause. Does that mean that the no action alternative would be not to develop a system of marine protected areas, or is it subject to appropriations? Sections 4C, 4D, and 4E seem to require actions that are not subject to appropriations. That's not clear. It's not clear the way it's written. Secondly, the EA does not contain a reasonable range of alternatives. There are only two alternatives. One of the alternatives is no action. The other one has a set of proposals that emphasize research, planning, and we need more than that. The assumption underlying the choice of alternatives in the existing document is that there is only one possible structure available to meet the purpose and need for action. This assumption is false, and the MPA Center has obligations to both consider viable alternatives to the one proposed and to allow the public to comment on such alternatives. In other words, the point that we are making here is that there are insufficient alternatives to be considered by the public. And the second thing is we have a problem with how the EA describes the affected environment. The new descriptions remain insufficient for establishing the baseline conditions. Absent such, the reader is unable to adequately determine or understand the impacts of the alternatives. And the environmental consequences section does not describe and analyze the anticipated environmental consequences of the proposed action as it relates to specifically the socioeconomic impacts. The socioeconomic impacts here appear to be slanted not towards fishing but toward other uses of MPAs. And it's not clear from the environmental assessment that there's been much consideration of fishing as a socioeconomic impact. And these things have to be addressed. And that's basically our problems with it.
Any comments from council members or questions for Dave? Dave.
Yes, actually I have a number of issues. First of all, I think the letter is good. I do think we should add some more to it, though. I'll call your attention to document number 4, which was passed out this morning, the letter that the North Pacific Council is sending in. By way of history of how we got this letter, my wife and George LaPointe are both on the Marine Protected Area Advisory Committee, and they are specifically tasked with coming up with comments on this document. And she received this yesterday and forwarded it to the staff. But I call your attention to the first two paragraphs because I think we might want to include similar language in our letter. I think it states the problem very well from the council's perspective of what's happening here. So that would be my first point. My second point, these are actually specific. I can give you page numbers in the document and the bullet number. The first is on page 19, number 3. under the nominating process, there are no public hearings required here. I personally feel, and I hope the council would concur, that there should be a required number of public hearings when an agency nominates an area for the national system. We're required by law to hold public hearings. This process is largely outside the public purview, and we need to make it very clear that it should be brought into the public purview. It was formed from an executive order. There's no legislative oversight. It occurs largely in a parallel universe, and it only interacts with what I call the real world here on a rather irregular basis. It calls for publishing notice in the Federal Register. That's great for us. We have the staff provides us with Federal Register notices, but most people don't get up and start their day every morning by reading the Federal Register. If they do, they got problems. So I think that, we need some other notification process beside the Federal Register. The public needs to know about these things. Another issue is what happens when there's more than one authority that manages an area. For example, overlapping state and federal jurisdictions, overlapping tribal and state jurisdictions, overlapping federal jurisdictions within the federal government. And the agencies disagree on the nomination. What's going to happen then? That needs to be spelled out. And lastly, the one that's most important to me personally is this issue of complying with NEPA. And it may sound like sour grapes, but, since we have to do it, I think everybody else should too. What this document says is basically they don't have to comply with NEPA until after the nomination is complete. And then they have acknowledged in this draft that they will have to comply at that point, which is a concession, because they were saying originally that they never had to comply with NEPA, that they could just do this. But I think that's an end run, and I think you should comply with NEPA right up front, not after the fact. I think if you're going to nominate areas, you should nominate a range of areas, or the NEPA process should kick in. We should have alternatives, and I think we should comment on that. I think we should say that NEPA should start at the beginning of the nomination process, not after it's completed. So those are the suggestions I have for incorporation in the letter, if the council concurs.
Any other council comments? Seeing none, I will go to the audience. Any comments? Back to the council. I think maybe we should use the same process we did before. Without objection, we will incorporate that. Chad? Are you going to object because you have to incorporate all of this?
No. Yeah, I don't actually feel like doing any work, so I'd like to object. No, I just wanted to editorialize for a moment on the MPA letter and particularly the North Pacific Council's letter, because I thought that their letter was excellent, and they addressed some points that I had and some curiosities that I had. The first thing I'd point out is that the National Register actually carries almost no authority, but they have a set of conservation objectives that are, from I think the council's perspective, potentially troubling, in that they're doing kind of this gaps analysis, or they're proposing to do a gaps analysis that's going to show where there might be gaps in marine protected areas and conservation objectives of marine protected areas, and it implies that they're going to have some sort of going in and throwing elbows and trying to motivate agencies that actually can create these marine protected areas to fill in their perceived conservation objectives. And their objectives and fishery management objectives and cultural heritage objectives could be wildly different. So it's really difficult to understand exactly how they're anticipating reconciling their set of objectives and what they're claiming, their gaps analysis, and how they're going to try to fill those gaps with the objectives of the agencies that they need to employ to create these MPAs. But, on the other hand, they can't create anything. Only the agencies that they're relying on can, and there's a very public process for doing that. So that was the main reason that I didn't include a lot of that stuff in the comments. Although I do think that the North Pacific Council's letter is excellent, I think that they are kind of overstating the jurisdictional conflicts, simply because the MPA policy has no regulatory authority. And then the other thing is that it's very difficult for anybody to comment on a 4-page environmental assessment. To call it deficient, I think you could probably do it in that one word. And so I kind of struggled a little bit with wanting to not pick it apart, because it was obvious that they didn't put a lot of effort into it. If they felt they could get a categorical exclusion, if they felt that the NEPA process might not apply to this, I kind of wish they would have just done that, and the fact that they didn't implies that maybe they can't, and maybe they need to do a better job. So that's why I focused so heavily on the NEPA process there. There are implications in their gaps analysis, and that should be highlighted through the cumulative effects thing. But I would point out that the North Pacific Council's letters are excellent. The things that I have for maybe beefing up the letter, this is important because the letter's due tonight at midnight, are the nominations and public hearings for nominating potential MPAs. Alternative notification means, besides just the Federal Register, were there other, those were the two main ones that I got from Dave's. Were there other concerns that the council had that we should include in this letter?
Did I understand from your comment then that you did not feel that the NEPA compliance issue was something that you wanted to include in there?
The NEPA compliance issue was so obviously deficient that I kind of feel like we'll probably leave it at where we are. I think I addressed it pretty well in the council's comments letter.
I think the only other one was, Dave, wasn't it the multiple authority issues?
Yeah, as far as the NEPA is concerned, what it says in the environmental assessment is activities undertaken by individual agencies in the future, such as changes in MPA regulations or the establishment of new MPAs as a result of implementation of a proposed revised draft framework, will undergo separate NEPA analysis by agency taking such actions as required and appropriate. That says nothing. That's, as Chad pointed out, that's insufficient. And as
David pointed out.
David.
Yeah, Chad is absolutely correct about how things get nominated. But what isn't said in this document is the fact that there is an end run here you can do, and that's to go to the president and have him issue an executive order to create the marine protected area, therefore bypassing all the rest of us. And therefore, that's why I think we need to comment on NEPA, because that issue is still very much outstanding about whether the president, in an executive order, has to comply with NEPA. I think raised it a few council meetings ago about the Navy with their sonar, and they lost a round on this when a judge ruled that they did have to comply with NEPA, that the president couldn't issue an executive order and just do an end run on the process. But this is a similar, this potentially is the same thing. To the gap analysis, I did actually leave that out. Again, they're saying they'll do the NEPA analysis after they've done the gap analysis rather than doing it up front. I think the timing is the issue here. Where does the NEPA process come in? I think it should come in first. They're saying it comes in after the fact. And I do think we should comment on that, that it should come in first. Again, because I'm concerned with how these things are going to come to be. I suspect they're going to come in the 23rd hour of the second term, as people are departing, you know, the helicopters running, start issuing the executive orders. And I don't think that's the way to do this kind of stuff.
Hey.
Yeah, to address that point, this executive order, 13158, has a number of flaws in the executive order itself. There is nothing in it that requires NEPA to be employed. And it was an 11th-hour end run by the Clinton administration that was originally challenged by the Bush administration, and then they decided to leave it in place. But what was left in place is deficient. There's no question it's deficient. It does not address those issues at all.
Chad, are you comfortable now with those comments?
The last comment that I got is to highlight the need for anticipating the impact of essentially what might come from the risk analysis and leaning on agencies to create MPAs in areas where gaps are identified. And I'll include a comment on that.
Paul.
I wonder, Chad, how you feel that, you know, we have all these marine managed areas or MPAs in New England here, and they were established based on NEPA process and on 10 national standards. And I'm concerned that once they become under a national system of MPAs, the executive order says, you know, enhance existing MPAs. And that enhance, I'm concerned that it might prohibit us or make it difficult to open a closed area, to do away with a closed area, you know, things like that, so that there is a hidden problem that once it becomes under the national system, we might not be able to do what we want to do with it. Do you see what I'm trying to say? So I think that's a key issue that we want to be able to manage fisheries with MPAs and marine managed areas, but not be held hostage to a different set of rules that they were established under.
Paul, are you suggesting that as an additional comment, or is that in the letter, or is that just an editorial comment of yours that is a concern?
I could easily include that as a comment in the letter. I think the way that it would play out for the council is that the council would have to think very hard after we understand fully the ramifications of nominating an area to be on this register. And again, frankly, the implications of that are not well spelled out in the document. So it's very difficult at this point for us to anticipate what it even means to put an area on the register. But it might be highly likely that areas that are used for rebuilding of fish stocks wouldn't be candidate areas for the MPA register, and that alone might have ramifications if the MPA center has a stated or unstated desire to include 30% of something in, you know, in identifying gaps. And I mean, it does get quite scary. So I think, you know, I'd be happy to put a comment along the lines of what Paul said in the letter.
Okay. Dave?
I think it's important to note that all marine managed areas are currently considered candidates to be MPAs, to be nominated as MPAs. So any federal, any state, any national reserve, anything that has any restriction in it is potentially a candidate, and I can't remember how many of them there are. I'm going to say 1,300. It might be 13,000. It's a big number. And Paul is absolutely correct that once it is, it's no longer within your control to just change the boundaries as you see fit. Or, in other words, if we want to change the boundaries of a closed area because we're more interested in letting people fish for haddock and more interested in protecting cod somewhere else, we won't be able to just do that as part of an amendment. We'll have to consult with the National Ocean Service and basically seek permission to do that. So it'll become vastly more complicated than it is now. So, you know, there are some very large ramifications to what's going on here. And again, I just can't stress enough that it's largely operating in a parallel universe that we don't interact with very often.
Okay. Again, without objection from the. Okay. Dave. Can you make a motion to the effect of us accepting this letter with the suggested changes?
Sure, I'll make that motion. I make a motion that we accept this letter as written with the addition of to accommodate the comments that have been made.
Is there a second to that? Okay. Dave Gaisel. Council comment? Seeing none. Audience comment? Seeing none, back to the council. Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed? Abstention? 2. Motion carries. Back to the chair.
Dave, anything else under Habitat?
No, that's it.
Okay. We'll move right into monkfish. Phil Herring, when you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay.
We're using the framework 6.